Well, I've appropriated the title of the first geodynamics lecture. And I think there's going to be a little bit of fluidity to the programs of all of the sub-disciplines. And I'll show you next the current status of the mineral physics program. And want to encourage you all to give us input into what you'd like to see, because there is flexibility. I think all of us will have some ability to change things as we go along, especially in the tutorial part of the program. So I want to do a couple of things. One is to give you a perspective for mineral physics of the Earth's interior. I think one of the things that's interesting about this short course is that it does represent four very different ways of looking at the Earth's interior, and I want to emphasizes one particular way that that mineral physicists think about the Earth's interior, or at least my interpretation of it, and then to review some basic aspects about the composition and the structure of the Earth's interior that we have learned, and to point out some of the big questions, the big remaining questions, and the big remaining problems, some of which we'll come back to in subsequent lectures, and some of which we'll also address in the tutorials. So first, let me give you an overview of the mineral physics program, which has an organizational structure that might not be as apparent as we would like on the web. The first third of the program covers the basics of mineralogy, petrology, and phase equilibria, ending with a review of thermodynamics that will lead into the next subject, which is an understanding of the fundamentals of physical properties of Earth materials. And these two aspects of mineral physics, the phase equilibria and the physical properties, you'll see me emphasize several times throughout the course of this first lecture. And then we'll end, the last third of our program, we'll end with frontiers, which will also give you a sense of the methods and the tools that we use to get at some of the geophysics questions that we want to answer from the experimental and the theoretical point of view. And then the last lecture, we'll try to put everything together into a sort of picture of the state of the knowledge and a more in-depth exploration of what questions remain. The tutorials are quite flexible still. The first one of these I expect will be tomorrow on constructing Earth models, where we'll look at some of the interactions between phase equilibria and physical properties. Okay. So some of the things I'll look at. One of the ways that mineral physics look at the Earth, or one of the things that's most distinctive about it, is that in some ways they think of the Earth as a material, as an experimental sample almost. An experimental sample with very unusual properties, one of which is its great mass, of course. Some of the things we want to know then about any sample, we also want to know about the Earth. What is it made of? What conditions is it at? Is it experiencing pressure, temperature, and so on? How does it respond to probes? If we probe the sample, we poke it and prod it in various ways, how does it respond? And how do we find out material properties, the properties that this material has, that this unusual material has? I'll then look at, review some basics of the structure and composition of the Earth's interior that we have learned, being careful to point out remaining questions, first focusing on the radial structure, the sort of one-dimensional structure, which is still teaching us a lot, and there's still lots of questions remaining there, and then getting to the meat of the sort of focus of this short course, which are the origins of mantle heterogeneity and what mineral physics can tell us about that, and what the significance of that heterogeneity is in understanding dynamics and the evolution of the Earth. So first, what is Earth made of? And I'm going to start way back. I'm going to start really basic, in part to give you a feeling for what our perspective is, and in part to give you an understanding of some of the fundamental assumptions or guiding principles, if you like, that all mineral physicists have in their heads about what the Earth is like and about how we go about answering questions. So at the most basic level, what is the Earth made of? Well, it's made of atoms, and that's not quite as trivial as it first sounds. Contrast a material made of atoms, like the Earth, with a material made of a plasma, like the Sun. Plasma is very different in the sense that, well, what is an atom? An atom is an object where the nucleus and the electrons are very closely associated with each other. The electrons are more or less tightly bound to the nucleus. That's not true of the stellar interior, the solar interior, where electrons and nuclei are not bound to each other. The nuclei are swimming around in a more or less uniform soup or sea of electrons. Very different state of matter. Okay, so this tells us something very peculiar and special about the Earth. Also, I mean something else by this statement that the Earth is made of atoms. And that is to remind ourselves that all of the processes we talk about in geophysics, everything having to do with the evolution, the dynamics, the differentiation of the Earth, all these processes are ultimately governed by two things. The way the atoms are arranged, that is the structure of the material, and the way the atoms are bonded together. That is the forces acting between atoms and the dynamics of the atoms. Okay, so all these processes come down to breaking and reformation of bonds in various configurations ultimately. And it's partly for that reason that it's important to think about the Earth at the atomic scale. So one way of thinking about it is to think about Hooke's law in sort of a generalized fashion. So in place of the literal force pulling on the spring, you could think of more generalized forces, such as a change in energy, a change in stress, and so on, and ask yourself what the response of the material will be to those changes. Those changes might be a change in the temperature of the material, of the phase of the material, a phase transformation, deformation of the material. And what relates then? The force to the response, in all cases, what relates them is some material property or combination of material properties. And this is the focus of much of mineral physics research, is to get at what these material properties are. And from this perspective, it is very important to go beyond the model of materials as continua. Much of the rest of geophysics deals with materials in the continuum approximation, okay? But it's important to go beyond that approximation in order to measure what these material properties are. Take the density, for example. How do we measure the density? The density is best measured by measuring the spacing between atoms, all right? So the best way we have of measuring the density by X-ray diffraction relies on this atomic picture very directly of materials. The atomic picture also gives us our most powerful way of understanding material properties. How do we understand the patterns or relationships of the material properties that one mineral has versus another? How do we understand how these material properties change with pressure, temperature, composition, and so on? It gives us a powerful theoretical framework, this atomic picture does, for understanding these very basic things. Going a little bit beyond that, the Earth is made of condensed matter, and what I mean by that is that the potential energy is important. Okay, and again, we can understand the significance of that by contrast with the ideal gas, say. The physical properties, the thermodynamics, the behavior of the air in this room is almost completely controlled by kinetic energy, by just the kinetics of the molecules rushing around and bumping into each other and into the walls of the room and so on. Not so for condensed matter. In condensed matter, you have a very different situation where potential energy is very important, even dominant, over much of Earth's conditions. That is, bonding is important. Atoms are tightly bound to one another. If you think about, for example, the energy of interaction between two atoms as a function of their separation, which is shown here, as they get very close to each other, they repel. As they get farther apart, they start to attract each other dominantly with Coulombic forces because ions tend to be oppositely charged. And in between, you have some happy medium of minimum potential energy, which represents the ideal bonded distance of these two atoms. The reason that there's no simple theory for condensed matter, or no simple form of any theory for condensed matter, is that the form of this function here, okay, which the interatomic bonds explore as they get pressed together at high pressure, the form of that function is very complicated and not known. Okay, so at the very simplest, most basic level, that's why we can't write the equation of state of the Earth's interior on the back of an envelope, as we can for the ideal gas, for example. Okay, so bonding matters a lot, potential energy matters a lot, and potential energy is complicated. I'll talk about where we are with theory, and we'll look at how far we've come from theory in a subsequent lecture. The theory is still approximate, but we can do a lot with it, and we'll explore that later. What kind of pressures are we talking about? What kind of how condensed or how compressed is this condensed matter in the Earth? Well, one way of thinking of it is to think about the pressure that it takes to fundamentally alter an interatomic bond. And one way of looking at that is to look at the ratio of a typical energy scale, an electron volt. This is an energy scale in which the separation between energy levels or electronic energy levels are measured. An electron volt divided by a typical separation between electrons in an Earth material, an angstrom cubed. And if you do all the unit conversion, you come up with 160 GPa, which is about the pressure in the mantle. Okay? So what that tells us is that the pressures in the mantle are sufficient to fundamentally alter the bonding. Alright, so bonding in the lower mantle is going to be different from what it is in the upper mantle and crust, and we'll need to worry about that. Okay? We can't just take our intuition from the mineralogy textbook and apply it directly to the deep interior. We'll need to look more deeply than that. At the same time, the pressure is not sufficient to alter the fundamental state of the matter. Still made of atoms. If you were to compress material much more than it is at the center of the Earth, compress it to pressures in the interior of Jupiter or the Sun or whatever, then you do start to fundamentally alter the state. The electrons do start to become delocalized, and you get a plasma. But the Earth, we're still in the realm of atoms. Continuing with this, with what the Earth is made of, it is solid, mostly. The outer core, of course, is an exception. We're focusing on the mantle primarily. In the mantle, you do get a little bit of melt occasionally and in very localized regions. And whatever melt does form very quickly escapes. Okay, so melt tends to be very localized in space and time, and that's why we tend to focus mostly on the properties of solids. As Don emphasized in his talk, the melt that does exist is very important because it's a major agent of chemical evolution and differentiation. Because it's solid, the time scales of deformation tend to be very long, and the way that it deforms depends on time very strongly and in very interesting ways, important ways for geophysics. And this can be characterized by forming this Maxwell relaxation time, which is the ratio of the viscosity of the material to the shear modulus. So for the viscosity of the upper mantle, we could take 10 to the 21 Pascal seconds. That seems to be a fairly popular number as constrained by post-glacial rebound, for example. For the shear modulus, we could take about 100 GPa. Again, doing the unit conversion, the Maxwell relaxation time would work out to be about 1,000 years. So that means that if you deform the material very quickly on timescales of much less than 1,000 years, it will respond elastically, okay, almost perfectly elastically, and that almost will be important later, almost perfectly elastically. And if you deform it on very long timescales, like the timescales of plate tectonics or mantle convection, it will flow. So we have there the distinction between seismology on the one hand, very rapid deformation of the material, very short time scale, and geodynamics on the other, very slow or long time scale deformation. Not only is it solid, it's mostly crystalline, and this is important for a number of reasons. One of the unique things about materials, multi-component materials below their melting point, is that they tend to segregate the elements into multiple phases. All right, so this is something that a fundamental property of multi-component solids that we have to deal with. The elements get segregated into different phases. So in the upper mantle, we've got the components not all combined into a single mineral, but divided up into olivine, clinopyroxene, orthopyroxene, garnet, and so on. All right. And all of those phases have very different properties and so on, and so we have to deal with that. The other reason why the crystalline nature of the mantle is important is that crystals, unlike other states of matter, are anisotropic. And if you consider the crystal structure of orthopyroxene, one of the important minerals in the Earth's upper mantle, you can kind of get an idea just by looking at the crystal structure of how anisotropic it is. We have these very stiff SiO4 tetrahedra here in blue, alternating with these much softer MgO6 octahedra in the sort of layered fashion, tetrahedra, octahedra, tetrahedra, octahedra, and so on. And so, for example, the material will deform very differently if you squeeze it in this direction versus squeezing it in this direction. So seismic waves will travel at different speeds in these two directions. And this anisotropy is a property that all mantle minerals have and that we have to be concerned with when thinking about the structure of the Earth's interior. Okay, so we have a general idea of what it's made of. We'll come back to the details of its composition in a minute. But first, let's think about, again, from this very general point of view, how does it respond? If we take our experimental sample, the Earth, and we poke it and prod it in various ways, change various conditions of its being, how does it respond to that? First of all, the changes in energy. And in terms of what the Earth has actually gone through, you might think of a variety of processes. One of the more exotic ones is shown here, this possible late-stage impact that might have formed the Moon. But I'm thinking of other less exotic things, too. You might think about the energy that's released by a decaying radioactive element. You might think about energy that's added to the mantle from the cooling of the core, and so on. So you change the energy of the material, what happens to it? Well, a lot of things are going to happen to it. One of the things that could happen to it is that its temperature will change. And that relationship between the amount of energy added and the amount that the temperature changes is governed by a material property, the heat capacity. And we'll come back to these material properties later, and I'll associate all of these responses to material properties that we'll return to. That change in temperature will also change the density. That's governed by the thermal expansivity here. And depending on the conditions and the composition of the material and the pressure and so on, that change in energy might also induce a phase transformation. That phase transformation might be one of partial melting. It might be one of transforming the crystals from one phase into another. It might be a change in the relative proportions of different phases in the mantle, and all of these will be important for understanding Earth's structure. What about to stress? How does the Earth respond to stress? And here we can think about two different kinds of stress, or two different classes of stress that might be applied. One of these tends to be very large in the Earth. The hydrostatic part of the stress is very large, hundreds of GPa. The deviatoric stress tends to be much smaller, in part because Earth materials can't support very large deviatoric stresses. So to hydrostatic stress, how does it respond? It responds by compression. And that compression, that is a decrease in the volume or an increase in the density. And that relationship between hydrostatic stress or pressure and density is governed by the bulk modulus, and we'll look at the distinction between the adiabatic and the isothermal bulk modulus in subsequent lectures. As you compress it, if you do it very quickly, or if the time scale is too short for heat to diffuse away, then you also get heating, and the rate of heating is governed by something called the Grüneisen parameter, which we'll return to later. And hydrostatic stress also induces phase transformations. And again, these can be of several types. A change in hydrostatic stress might induce melting, as it does under the mid-ocean ridge. As the material rises and the pressure is released, the material melts. It might involve a transformation from one phase to another, such as those that are responsible for the seismic discontinuities in the Earth's mantle. Or it might involve just a more subtle change in the relative proportions of phases. And we'll come back to examples of that in a minute. What about deviatoric stress? How does it respond to deviatoric stress? Well, here is where the anisotropy of Earth materials really comes into play. Because Earth materials respond to an anisotropic stress anisotropically. Okay, the strain is also anisotropic. And we have to think about the time scale over which the deviatoric stress is applied. Because of the Maxwell relaxation time, which has the sort of interesting value that's in between the seismic time scale and the geodynamic time scale. At short time scales, the material will respond elastically, and that response is governed by a tensor, a fourth rank tensor, and we'll think about tensors in the subsequent lecture. And that tensor is called the elastic constant tensor. Stress is a second rank tensor, strain is a second rank tensor, and two second rank tensors are related by a fourth rank tensor. So the elastic constants are a fourth rank tensor. Deform it at very long time scales, and it responds by flow, and that response is governed by another material property, the viscosity. The viscosity, well, it relates stress, which is a second rank tensor, to strain rate, which is a second rank tensor. So the viscosity in general is a fourth rank tensor. We usually don't think of it that way, but it is, and the fact that it is a fourth rank tensor may be important for some aspects of the Earth's dynamics. And if you're at very low temperatures or you apply deviatoric stresses that exceed the strength of the material, or various other conditions are met, you can also produce failure. And this is one of the things, of course, that happens in an earthquake, and there are other times when failure can occur. This picture, by the way, just reminds us of the anisotropy of Earth materials. What it is a thin section of a sample from the upper mantle. This is a xenolith from Udakhnaya in Siberia, and it's under cross polars in the optical microscope, if you know what that is. If you don't know what it is, I'll just tell you that what the colors are telling you is that light is traveling through these olivine crystals at different speeds in different directions, and that's what's giving you the color. And it's a reflection of the anisotropy of the olivine crystal, a very visual representation of that. And just as the index of refraction tensor is anisotropic, so is the elastic constant tensor. We'd also like to know how quickly it responds to these various perturbations, especially to the stress, to the deviatoric stress. Because this bears very directly on things like plate tectonics, what produces that map on the right, for example. We'd also like to know what the rates of mass transport are, chemical diffusivity, for example, how rapidly do atoms move in a chemical potential gradient, energy, how rapidly is energy transferred, thermal diffusivity, how rapidly are electrons transferred, momentum. You can think of viscosity as momentum diffusivity. We'll come back to these transport properties in a subsequent lecture. And many of these, of course, go into governing the rate of mantle convection, or the vigor of mantle convection through the Rayleigh number, something that no doubt will come up in subsequent lectures on geodynamics. Some of these are examples of non-equilibrium properties. That is, the material property itself depends on the time scale of the perturbation. Another example of a non-equilibrium property is the attenuation, or Q. And throughout our lectures, we'll make a distinction between equilibrium properties on the one hand, which are much simpler to understand, versus non-equilibrium properties on the other hand, which involve different kinds of theory and different ways of looking at materials. So how do we find out? How do we figure out what the material properties are? How do we go about that? And there are two basic ways, experimental and theoretical. On the top is a former colleague of Abby Kavner, Sandra Caldwell, holding a diamond cell. And what often surprises people is just how small the diamond cell is. This apparatus is capable of generating pressures greater than the center of the Earth. I mean, this is an amazing piece of machinery here, so simple. And at the bottom, of course, is an integrated circuit. Pictures of computers are really boring, but they often disguise just how remarkable the technology is. And I thought this image of an integrated circuit captured it much better. One way to address this question of how do we find out is to ask ourselves a very simple question. How does the Earth's interior differ from the laboratory? And of course it differs in a lot of ways. And what we have to do is ask ourselves, what are the significant differences? What are the differences that matter in terms of measuring material properties? And what differences matter depend on what material property you're talking about. And this gets back to the distinction between equilibrium properties versus non-equilibrium properties. Equilibrium properties, and we'll go through part of the proof of this, we won't go through all the gory details, but part of it in the thermodynamics lecture, is that equilibrium properties depend only on pressure, temperature, and major element composition. Now that's a remarkable statement, because think of all the other things that a material experiences that don't affect its material properties. The rate of deformation, proximity to the coromantle boundary, depth, history of deformation, manner of formation, whether crystallization for a melt or whether transformation from another phase. None of these things matter. The only thing that matters is pressure, temperature, and major element composition. And this is part of the foundations of thermodynamics, this statement that I'm making, and it's a very important one and a very powerful one that really forms the basis of much of what mineral physicists do in being able to reproduce the essential conditions of the Earth's interior in the laboratory. Okay? So all you have to do, in quotes, is produce the pressures and temperatures that exist down there, control them, and then measure your sample while it's at pressure and temperature. Of course, in the generation of the pressure and temperature and the measurement in situ lie a lot of challenges, and Abby will get to those in a subsequent lecture on experimental methods. Or you can compute them theoretically, and we'll talk about theoretical methods later and some of the challenges there and some of the approximations that we're forced to make and how good or how bad these approximations are. Some non-equilibrium properties are very different. Some non-equilibrium properties depend on a lot more variables. For example, they might depend on minor element or trace element composition in a very essential way. They might depend on the history of the material, how it was formed or how it's been deformed. Something like the viscosity might depend on these things in very critical ways. And this makes it much more difficult to deal with non-equilibrium properties, because the history of deformation is something that's difficult to replicate in the laboratory, both because the time scales of an experimenter's lifetime are very different from the time scales of deformation in the Earth, and because we don't know a lot, or we know less about what the deformation history of a particular parcel of mantle might be in the Earth's interior. So they're difficult to replicate in the lab. They're also more difficult to control in the laboratory. Minor element compositions are more difficult to measure than major element compositions, for example. Okay, so just some examples of results that mineral physicists have produced about some essential properties that are important for interpreting structure, composition, dynamics, and so on. Just two examples of many that I could have chosen. An example from experiment here, where the group at Lyon has measured the volume of olivine as a function of temperature, and they've gone to quite high temperatures this time. This is the highest temperature measurement of the thermal expansion of olivine. Of any mantle mineral, I think. That may be true. And what the dots here represent are the experimental data, and what the lines represent are various thermodynamic models of that data, if you like, and an examination of the sensitivity to variations in the value of the Grüneisen parameter here, plus or minus one, and in the volume derivative of the Grüneisen parameter. And these are two properties that will come back, two parameters, if you like, that we'll come back to again and again. The volume in this case is measured by X-ray diffraction. There are other ways to do it, but X-ray diffraction turns out to be the most flexible, the most powerful way to do it in most cases. So you need to generate the pressure and temperature, the pressure by the diamond cell, the temperature generally either by laser heating or some kind of external heating of larger parts of the diamond anvil cell. There are also other ways of generating pressure, large volume apparati, and I imagine Abby will get to some of these later. And then you have to probe the sample in situ. How are you going to probe it? While it's sitting in between the diamonds at high pressure and temperature, this very small sample volume, how do you probe it? That's no easy task either. Okay, another way to find out is with theoretical methods. And the equations that we solve are called the Kahn-Sham equations. And this guy, Walter Kahn, this building is named after him, actually, it turns out. And he won the Nobel Prize for these equations for density functional theory. And these are a recasting, essentially, of the Schrödinger equation in a form that is more convenient or more useful or more powerful for application to condensed matter. The equations are not. Well, the equations are exact, but we can't solve them. So in order to solve them, we have to make approximations. It's not a technical limitation. It's not that we just don't have enough computer time. We don't know what the functional form of some of the terms in the equations are. So this is really the limits of our knowledge of the physics, of solid-state physics. And the example I show you here is the temperature derivative of the shear modulus of MgSO3 perovskite. So if you want to look at lateral heterogeneity in the mantle, for example, how does the shear velocity vary from one place to another in the lower mantle? Part of what goes into that is how the shear modulus varies from one place to another with temperature, okay? Part of it is due to lateral variations in temperature. And so if you want to interpret those lateral variations in shear wave velocity, such as those that Adam showed this morning, in terms of lateral variations in temperature, this is one of the things you would like to know. And compared our two different first principles calculations based on solutions of the Kahn-Sham equation, for this property, and a more approximate non-first principles calculation here, and again various attempts to thermodynamically model this dependence, this rather strong dependence of dg dt on pressure. Okay, what are the conditions of our sample? And this it's a sort of eccentric sample in a lot of ways. One of the ways that it's eccentric is that it's generating its own pressure and temperature, of course, via its own gravity, self-gravitation, and self-compression. In fact, if you look at the pressure in the Earth's interior, you cannot understand the pressure just by self-gravitation alone. The compression due to that self-gravity is essential, okay? It fundamentally modifies the pressure distribution in the Earth's interior. You can't approximate the pressure in the Earth's interior by a constant density material, in other words. So self-compression is also important. To a large extent, the sample is generating its own temperature, too, because as it self-compresses, it also heats up. That's one way to think of it, anyway. Adiabatic heating. And we'll look at the rate at which it heats up with compression. Depends on the Grünheisen parameter again. We'll come back to that. Also depends on lots of other things, including the rate of energy generation due to radioactive decay and the rate of transport of energy and mass in the Earth's interior. And then what about the composition? We'll look at the composition in a little more detail later. One thing we do know about the composition is that it's probably very heterogeneous. Crust, mantle, and core are very different. And one of the key questions for the focus of this short course is, to what extent is the mantle heterogeneous in composition? And I'll come back to that in a minute. This picture of a meteorite, a thin section from a meteorite, reminds us of some of these issues. The meteorite consists of a lot of iron and a lot of silicate lighted up here. The iron is these opaque regions here. So that's the most basic heterogeneity in the Earth's interior between mantle and core. But then there are other heterogeneities that develop afterwards as well, such as the formation of the crust, as Don talked about. Okay, so let's look a little more quantitatively at these things. The depth goes to 6,300 kilometers or so. The pressure we know pretty well, basically from seismology, from zero, essentially zero at the surface. It's one bar, but I'm going to say zero for one bar throughout my lectures, because the difference between zero and one bar is utterly insignificant in terms of physical properties, phase equilibria, anything else that mineral physicists are interested in, by and large. 24 GPA at the boundary between upper and lower mantle, 136 GPA at the core mantle boundary, 360 GPA at the center of the Earth. So this gives us an idea of what the pressure scales are, about 0 to 100 GPA throughout the mantle. That, as I said, comes mostly from seismology. The temperature comes mostly from mineral physics. We have estimates of, and I'll get back to where these estimates come from, of something like 1800 K. The error bars on these, on this one is probably plus or minus 100. On this one, probably plus or minus 500. 1800 Kelvin, about 3000 Kelvin at the core mantle boundary, and then up to 6000 at the center. The composition, very broad brush view, oxides and silicates in the upper mantle, transition zone, and lower mantle. We'll look at this in more detail in a little bit. Core made of an iron alloy. Important to remind ourselves, though, that most of the constraints on the composition of the Earth's interior, or a lot of the constraints, come from rather shallow depths. We have samples of the Earth only from the upper 200 kilometers or so. There may be some exceptions to that. People have claimed samples from much greater depths, but these are not confirmed just yet. It'd be interesting if they were true. Other constraints on composition too, which I'll get back to. Yes?
When you say the pressure data comes from seismology, is it come via bulk measurement of the bulk modules?
No, from the density primarily. Yeah, partly also from the bulk modulus as well. And I'll get back in a little bit to how we get that pressure distribution. Yeah. In fact, right here. So, an assumption that we make about the Earth's interior is that it's in hydrostatic equilibrium. That allows us to write that first equation up there, which says that the pressure gradient is related to the density and the gravitational acceleration at that depth. So in order to get the pressure versus depth, you need to know the density versus depth. And how do you sort of break this this cycle between pressure and density? One way is to combine it with another equation, which involves a material property, the bulk modulus here. And I've left the subscript of the bulk modulus off on purpose. I'll come back to that, which says that the rate at which pressure changes with density is related to the bulk modulus over the density. Okay, and if you combine these equations, then you can figure out what the pressure distribution in the Earth's interior is from some knowledge of the bulk modulus and the density. K is the bulk modulus. And the thing about the bulk modulus here is that you have to account for phase transformations. So, we have to be careful about the bulk modulus. The bulk modulus is not the one that's measured seismologically, okay? If you put the one that's measured seismologically into these equations and solve it naively, you'll get the wrong answer, okay? So the Earth models that have been constructed based on seismology have been much more careful than that and have taken into account the major phase transitions as detected as seismic discontinuities in the Earth's mantle. From the mineral physics perspective, the way we would think about this is that we have to take this relationship between pressure and density literally. That is, there will be some depths in the Earth that, when you apply some pressure, a phase transition will be induced, and the density will rise much more rapidly than if you're in a region where no phase transformation is taking place. Let's see, where am I? Okay. Yeah, I'll keep going and I'll come back to that. Okay, temperature. What about temperature? What constraints do we have on temperature? Well, near the surface, we have some constraints based on heat flow. That gives us some idea about the temperature gradient in the Earth's interior. Modeling of the magma source, as we've got rocks on the surface, we know they were produced by some igneous process, by some combination of observations of that rock and various experiments. We can invert for, if you like, the source region of that magma. And we have something called geothermobarometry, which is just based on the idea that the compositions of phases that are coexisting in a rock depend on pressure and temperature. Okay, so if you turn that problem around, you've got a xenolith at the surface, you measure the compositions of coexisting phases, you can invert for the pressure and temperature from which that rock came. What about in the interior? What constraints do we have on the interior? Well, there are seismic discontinuities. There are depths in the Earth at which the seismic velocities change suddenly. One of the contributions of mineral physics over the past several decades is to associate these seismic discontinuities with phase transformations. The pressure or depth at which these phase transformations occur depends on temperature. So by matching the pressure of the phase transformation, which depends on temperature, to the depth of the seismic discontinuity, you can figure out what the temperature probably is at the depth of the seismic discontinuity. So at the 410 seismic discontinuity and the 660 seismic discontinuity, we have a pretty good idea of what the temperature is. What about the slope here? What about the slope of this line that I've drawn? The slope of the line is based on the assumption that the gradient, that the temperature gradient in the interior is adiabatic. If it is adiabatic, and there's a connection there to mantle dynamics, which will come out in subsequent lectures, I'm sure. If it is adiabatic, then that gradient is governed by essentially a single property, the Grüneisen parameter. And we think we have some idea of what the value of that parameter is, and so therefore we know we have some idea of what the gradient is. Another way to constrain the temperature at depth is through the physical properties of the materials. We can measure, for example, the density of mantle minerals and compare those densities to the densities of the Earth's interior as observed or modeled based on seismic observations. If you put all this together, and different mineral physicists will come up with slightly different answers, but not radically different answers, the temperature increase across the mantle, mostly due to adiabatic heating, is about 1,000 degrees. There are funny little kinks in here, and these are due to something called the Verhoeven effect. Basically, what's going on is that there are phase transformations here, and these phase transformations have a certain latent heat associated with them. So depending on whether the phase transformation releases or absorbs latent heat, the temperature might jump up a little or jump down a little as the material passes through the phase transformation. The big questions here are the assumption that I've made. The temperature profile is adiabatic. That's a big assumption. To what extent is it adiabatic? Is it not adiabatic? Okay, there are lots of ways of getting at that. We'll explore some of those ways. The other big question is, what are the boundary layers? Adiabaticity is connected to the idea of a vigorously convecting mantle. If you have a region in the Earth's interior which is a physical barrier to flow, such as the core mantle boundary, then heat is being transported very differently, and there's no reason to expect an adiabatic temperature gradient at those physical boundaries. So at the core mantle boundary, there is a dynamical boundary layer and almost certainly a thermal boundary layer of some form, of some magnitude. What the magnitude of that is, we don't know. So the temperature might ramp up rapidly at the core mantle boundary, much higher than this adiabatic hypothesis that I've examined here. There might be other boundary layers in the Earth's interior, physical barriers to flow. Maybe within the lower mantle, we'll look at that later. Maybe associated with some of these phase transitions, we'll look at that. Okay, what is the composition? There are lots of constraints. There are extraterrestrial constraints from meteorites. We talked about that. Don talked about that earlier. Also from our understanding of nucleosynthesis, which is now pretty good, I understand. This is a model of cosmic abundances of the elements. And what's interesting is that even if you go all the way back to nucleosynthesis, to the relative abundance of the elements in the universe, you come up with something that doesn't look too different from the Earth, at least in some ways. The most abundant elements pop out as being rather abundant in the universe as well. Of course, the biggest difference between Earth and the universe is hydrogen and helium. The universe is almost all hydrogen. The Earth has very little hydrogen. And so differentiation, segregation, volatility are obviously important in the formation of the Earth. Other constraints near the surface come from xenoliths, samples of the mantle, and from, again, modeling of the magma source. You've got a basalt of a certain composition, figure out what rock partially melted to produce a basalt of that composition, and at what pressure and temperature. And again, that's a modeling or inversion exercise. Other constraints come from comparison of physical properties as measured by mineral physicists experimentally or theoretically, comparison of those properties to observed or model properties based on in situ or seismic observations of the Earth's interior. As I mentioned already, fractionation is very important. Most fundamentally between the Earth, the hydrosphere, and space. A lot of the elemental inventory of the universe never got accreted to Earth in the first place. Only the less volatile elements did. And then even within the solid Earth, there's very important differentiation between crust, mantle, and core. And again, in the context of this short course, the big question is the mantle itself homogeneous? Okay, you've extracted the crust, the core formed really early. What about the mantle itself? Is it homogeneous? Well, as Don showed, it's not in trace elements. What about major elements? Is it homogeneous in major elements? This is still a big unanswered question. We don't know the answer to it. If you put all these constraints together, you come up with a compositional model of the mantle that most mineral physicists would be relatively happy with, that can go by various names, pyrolite, larsolite, pyritite, and I'm being fuzzy about the name here because the names themselves are fuzzy. None of these names implies a specific composition, but rather a range of compositions, a range of relative compositions. And if you consider those ranges, all of these names overlap with each other, and all of them overlap with the constraints that we have from these various sources on the composition of the major element composition of the mantle. Okay, so one of the properties of solids that I mentioned is that solids segregate into multiple phases. All right, this is very different from a gas. There are lots of different atoms in the air in this room, nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen, argon, whatever. But they're very happy to be in a single phase, all right? There's no tendency to phase separation, to separation of oxygen in one phase and nitrogen in another. Solids are really different. The olivine takes up more of the magnesium, the garnet takes up more of the aluminum. The elements, in other words, separate into these very distinct blobs, into these very distinct phases with different physical properties. And these different phases undergo phase transformations throughout the mantle. Their relative proportions change, their compositions change, and so on. It's a distinctive property of multi-component solids. So in the upper mantle, what do we have? We've got a picture of what we think of, at least, as the upper mantle over here. We have olivine. We have two pyroxenes, orthopyroxene and clinopyroxene. And we have an aluminous phase, a phase that contains a lot of aluminum, that is. And which aluminous phase is important depends on depth. The shallowest depths, plagioclase is the aluminous phase. At intermediate depths, say down to 60, 80 kilometers, spinel is the aluminous phase, and below that, garnet is the primary aluminous phase. In the transition zone, we get lots of phase transformations. There are changes in the relative abundance of phases in the upper mantle as well, but in the transition zone, they really start to show up in the structure of the Earth. We have transformations of olivine into two high-pressure polymorphs, first wasleyite and then ringwoodite. such polymorphic phase transitions. Think of the transformation of graphite to diamond, for example. How does diamond form? Starts out as graphite, goes to high pressure, gets transformed to diamond. Same composition, carbon in both cases, but the atoms are arranged in a different way, different structure. And that's what's going on here too. Olivine, Westlake, Ringwoodite, all of the same composition, but the atoms arranged in subsequently tighter and tighter, closer and closer packing, a more dense arrangement of the atoms. Other things go on too. The pyroxenes actually start to dissolve into the garnet. So the pyroxenes start to disappear as you go deeper into the transition zone, and the garnet starts to become more abundant. So that by the time you get into about the middle of the transition zone, garnet is the second most abundant phase. It's making up something like 40% of the mantle. So we have the olivine polymorphs making up about 60%, and then garnet making up as much as 40%. In the lower mantle, the mineralogy, as far as we can tell, and there are lots of experiments bearing on this, the mineralogy gets a bit simpler. We have two perovskites and an oxide. The perovskite structure is something that Abby will talk about next time. We have lots of reason to believe that this perovskite mineral is the most abundant in the Earth. One, because the lower mantle is a big place. It's by far the biggest part of the mantle. Second, we have no evidence that it undergoes phase transformations over most of that pressure range. We'll come back to evidence throughout the course of subsequent lectures that it may transform to another phase at the very, very base of the mantle, right around the D double prime region, very close to the core mantle boundary. We'll come back to that. And that's what I emphasize in this last question here, is that in our confident statements about perovskite being the most abundant mineral in the Earth and so on, we have to remind ourselves that most of the pressure temperature region of the Earth's interior is still relatively little explored. Okay, most experiments don't go beyond 30 GPa as far as determinations of phase equilibria go. There have been a few phase equilibrium experiments at higher pressures. But we have to be careful and always wonder in the back of our minds, what else is there? What other phase transformations might there be? Okay, so let's look at the structure of the Earth's interior. The structure is influenced by pressure and temperature, but also phase transformations. And the phase transformations play a very important role, especially in the shallower parts of the mantle, down to, say, 1,000 kilometers depth. They play a role which is at least as important as pressure. So what we have here is some physical property. It could have been anything. I could have plotted density. The plot would have looked very much the same. Some physical property versus depth, down to, in this case, 700 kilometers. And what I've shown are the shear wave velocities of the individual phases that make up the mantle, pelagic clay, spinel, garnet, the majoritic or silica-rich component of garnet, orthopyroxene, clinopyroxene, olivine, westlake, ringwoodite, magnesio-woustite, perovskite, calcium perovskite, and akimotoite. We'll see all these names again later. And the lines extend over the range of stability of the phase. And so you get an impression of how the shear wave velocity increases as you go to these higher pressure polymorphs throughout the transition zone and then into the lower mantle, where the velocities of the minerals that exist at those pressures are much higher. This is, yes, the dashed line, thanks for pointing that out. The dashed line here is a seismological model called PREM, which Adam and Don Anderson put together some years ago. And there is this decrease in the velocity here. And this is what's known as the low velocity zone. And I'll come back to that in a little bit, where that comes from. The reason none of the minerals show that is because I've plotted the minerals along an adiabat, okay? And so my plots of the mineral properties don't take into account some of the oddities of thermal structure near the surface, in particular cooling due to conduction. And I'll put that in a later slide, and we'll see what effect that has. Okay, so let's put all those minerals together, okay, taking into account the pressure range over which they're stable, put them all together. At a given pressure, you know how much of each phase there is, so you can figure out what the physical properties of the aggregate is, of the rock, that is, and plot that versus depth. And here I plotted the density, but again, I could have plotted anything, and it would have looked very much the same. And what I'll do is I'll show a series of slides, starting from the largest view, the entire mantle, and focusing in on increasingly narrow sections. Let's focus first on the lower mantle. And what you see in the lower mantle is this very smooth, almost linear variation of physical properties in the lower mantle. And that simple structure is based on our current understanding of what pyrolite does at these pressures. As far as we know, until very recently, and we'll put this in later in subsequent lectures, there aren't any phase transformations down here. We'll come back to this very recent one that somebody thinks they've discovered very close to the core mantle boundary. So the big question is the lower mantle really that boring? Is it really that simple? Is the structure really that simple? Or are there phase transformations that we haven't found yet? Or are there heterogeneities in the composition within the lower mantle that we may not have thought about yet? And what might the evidence for that be? And how what might we address that from the mineral physics perspective? We'll come back to all these things. Okay. The other problem is that the pressures in the lower mantle and the temperatures are very high. And the higher in pressure and temperature you go, the more scarce experimental data and theoretical calculations get. And so the less we know and the more the uncertainties grow. Now zooming in on just the upper 1,000 kilometers of the mantle, we see a much richer structure in the radial profile. We've got all kinds of stuff going on, shallow discontinuities here from plagioclase to spinel and from spinel to garnet. We have the 410 and the 660 discontinuities here. We also have a 520 here. And we see this local minimum in the shear wave velocity. And what is that caused by? What I've done in this case is to plot physical properties along not an adiabat, but an adiabat that's modified by 100 million years of half-space cooling at the surface. All right? So I've allowed the temperature to cool. It's 300K at the surface, and I've allowed that cooling to extend into the mantle. And so what you have near the surface is this very steep thermal gradient. Now, if you look at the density or the velocities, all of them, almost all of them, increase with pressure and decrease with temperature. Okay? So what's happening is that we have a thermal gradient that's exceeded some critical value, such that the increase in temperature is outweighing the increase in pressure. Things are decreasing more because of temperature than they're increasing because of pressure. And that's what gives you this initial decrease in velocities here. Eventually, the pressure effect takes over because the gradient flattens out, and the properties increase with pressure again. Okay. Again, this is as far as we are a best guess of what the properties of pyrolite are, a homogeneous major element compositional model of the mantle. Some big questions, especially when you're talking about this this local minimum here, which we could associate with the low velocity zone, would be the role of anisotropy, also in producing some of the discontinuities that might exist in the shallow mantle, and the role of attenuation, which might be particularly important in the vicinity of that low velocity zone.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
So if there's a density minimum there, what keeps it from flipping over?
That's an interesting question. Let's see. It may be that the length scale over which that density minimum occurs is too small to induce a dynamical instability. But I'm not sure.
The answer is that something like that could be maintained dynamically, but it wouldn't, that's typically uncomposable in a static case.
Right, right.
You could see it in the other
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question. Okay, let's zoom in one more level. focusing in now just on the 660 kilometer discontinuity. And all I want to emphasize here is that the structure of these discontinuities can be interesting and can be informative. These discontinuities, we think, are caused by phase transformations. And so if you turn that around, they give you what might be a very sensitive probe of what the major element composition of the mantle is, maybe our most powerful probe of that. I don't think we've exhausted all of the power that these represent in terms of the seismic resolution of how big these discontinuities are and the depth range over which they occur, and also in our knowledge of the phase equilibria which produce these discontinuities. And the only thing I wanted to point out here is that in this particular sort of best guess calculation of what pyrolite does, the 660 comes in two steps. First akimotoite to perovskite, then ringwoodite to perovskite plus magnesium worsdite. And this is an intriguing thing, an intriguing feature, especially if it were also seen in seismic studies. And the questions again are how well do we know these things? How well do we know these phase transformations and how they depend on composition and so on? All right. What about three-dimensional structure? Where does mantle heterogeneity come from? So here's a tomographic image, much like the ones that Adam was showing this morning. And we see reds and blues, and the reds, of course, represent areas of anomalously low velocity, and the blues high velocity. And one of the things we'd like to address is what is causing these anomalies. What's causing these lateral variations in seismic wave velocities? Certainly temperature is at least part of the story. Maybe it's the whole story, but it's at least part of the story. Because we know that seismic wave velocity depends on temperature. It gets lower as you increase the temperature. Okay? So these regions might just be hot and these regions might just be cold. From the mineral physics perspective, you do expect, though, other contributions to mantle heterogeneity. Temperature is certainly one of them. Most physical properties do depend on temperature. There are some that are nearly independent of temperature, like the heat capacity, constant volume, but most of them do. Elastic constants, these are the properties that control the speed of seismic wave propagation, mostly decrease the temperature, although not all of them. Here's one that actually increases very slightly with temperature initially. The rate at which these elastic constants change with temperature depends very strongly on the material you're talking about, or the bulk composition of your rock, or the pressure that you're at. There are few measurements, though, of elastic constants at high pressure and temperature, and so we have a lot to learn about this, although there are some measurements, as I've shown here, at zero pressure, and there are also a growing number of measurements at low temperature and high pressure. This is something that a lot of mineral physics groups are working on. Lateral variations in physical properties, as they depend on temperature, of course, also drive dynamics. Lateral variations in temperature produce lateral variations in density, which drive mantle flow. You expect, as you move from one part of the mantle to another, that the phase assemblage will be different, all right? You'll have a different set of phases in one part of the mantle as you do in another, even at the same depth, all right, just because the temperatures are different. Sometimes you'll get a dramatic change in the phase assemblage, okay, from a perovskite-bearing assemblage in one place to a perovskite-free assemblage in another. At other depths, it'll be a more subtle modification of the relative amounts of different phases, okay? But the phases will change no matter where you are in the upper 1,000 kilometers of the mantle. Maybe at greater depths too. As far as we know, no, but we can't rule it out. Anyway, in the upper 1,000 kilometers, this is going to be a player in determining mantle heterogeneity. Because these different phases do have very different physical properties, and the pressure at which the transformation occurs depends on temperature. All right, and so the pressure, the depth at which this transformation between olivine and wazolite, for example, occurs will be at a different place at high temperature than low temperature. The relative amounts of garnet and pyroxene will depend on temperature as well. And the As the mantle undergoes these phase transformations, latent heat will be absorbed or released, the density will change, and these will play into the dynamics too. And they may alter mantle dynamics in very important ways. What about lateral heterogeneity and major element composition? Right? Does this exist? One, that's one of the biggest questions. If it does exist, it will almost certainly contribute to seismic heterogeneity, if it's significant, if it's heterogeneity in the major elements, because physical properties do depend on composition. And the phase proportions, the proportions of different phases, also depends on composition. Major element heterogeneity, even if it's at a relatively subtle scale, will be dynamically active. The amount of density heterogeneity that's driving mantle dynamics is not large. It's only a few percent. And so if you've got a few percent lateral variation in, say, iron or calcium or magnesium, that could affect mantle dynamics as much as lateral variations in temperature. Okay, so the origin of lateral heterogeneity has these three sources: lateral variations in temperature, composition, or phase. In principle, all three of these contribute. And the interesting thing about them is that they're all connected to each other. Just as one example, lateral variations in composition might include lateral variations in the amount of radioactive heat-producing elements, which would play into the temperature. Lateral variations in temperature might induce partial melting, which could then feed back into the composition through differentiation and so on. Okay, so I'll stop there. The aluminum goes into the perovskite, as far as we can tell, into the magnesium-rich perovskite. The experiments that demonstrate that are a few diamond cell experiments on a whole rock pyrolytic composition, which find only two perovskites and an oxide, and some experiments on the solubility of aluminum into perovskite. So, as far as we can tell, aluminum doesn't form a separate phase in the lower mantle. One of the interesting things about aluminum, though, is that it really loves garnet, and garnet hangs on below the 660-kilometer discontinuity for a significant way. And if we look at the radial structure, this one, yeah. So, in sort of anthropomorphic terms, the aluminum likes garnet so much that the garnet survives well below the 660-kilometer discontinuity before finally giving up its aluminum to perovskite. And that's what causes this high gradient zone here below the 660-kilometer discontinuity itself. Yeah?
Did you use the terms garnet and major interchangeably?
Yes, I did. I did use them interchangeably. Because it is a continuous solid solution, at least in terms of the mantle. You go from pure garnet to a garnet with a lot of majorite component continuously.
Garnet just means the structure, but majorite is a type of garnet that has certain
silicon. Has more silicon than normal garnet does, and less aluminum.
Okay.
Yeah. So, what we're talking about here is that, let me see if I can show this. This is good because it'll get us thinking about mineralogy a little bit more. Okay, there's the formula of one form of garnet, the magnesium-rich form of garnet called pyrope. And if we look at this guy here, these two aluminums, they each have a charge of +3, so that group of two aluminums has a charge of +6. Here's another thing that has a charge of +6, MgSi, okay? So we could substitute that pair of aluminums for an MgSi pair. OK, Okay, like that. Or as we might write it more compactly, MG4SI4012. Still the same structure. This is pyrope garnet. And this is majorite garnet. And to a first approximation, this is what happens to the garnet as you go from a depth of 100 kilometers, say, to a depth of about 500 kilometers. The aluminum is replaced by magnesium and silicon, which the garnet grabs from the pyroxenes. Okay, so as the pyroxenes dissolve into the garnet, magnesium and silicon get added, and you end up with a much more silica-rich garnet than you started with.
So in that graph, when you have the garnet and you have the majorite, the garnet was indicating the pyrite.
Exactly, exactly. And the majorite was indicating this guy. And they have different elastic properties, and so that plays that. So one component of the high gradient that you have in the transition zone is this transformation from garnet to majorite, and the disappearance of the pyroxenes just have low density in favor of the garnet, which has much higher density. And that's a significant contributor to the high gradient that you have in the transition zone. Yeah?
I was wondering, in the same figure, you had a question about the minimum of the density. Would it be right to look at it as the fact that there's not inversion, as in, because we're looking at the lithosphere here and the temperatures are not hot enough for it?
Yeah, as far as we know, there's no melting going on. You don't need melt to generate this local minimum. You can do this in a purely solid state. Whether the sluggish dynamics of the lithosphere help to make this density minimum more dynamically stable is sort of a quantitative question that I don't know how to answer exactly. Yeah. Ah, Akimoto-White. Let me go back to a previous slide. Okay, Akimoto-White. Yes, we will see these again. MgSiO3, same composition as perovskite or orthopyroxene. This is Akimoto-White. It used to be called ilmenite. Okay. And this brings up an interesting point about the names of these guys. All right? You're not allowed to name a mineral unless you find it in nature. Okay? Now, some of these phases haven't been found in nature yet. They've only been seen in the laboratory, and we only think they're down there. Okay? Because when we take a rock that is representative of the upper mantle and squeeze it, we get these minerals. Perovskite, for example, has not been found in nature yet. A lot of the minerals have been found in nature. Akimoto, it was recently found in nature in a meteorite. And what this, and I forgot to say, what this pretty picture is a picture of ringwoodite. This is a meteorite in which ringwoodite formed, this high-pressure polymorph of olivine. And so ringwoodite is an example of a high-pressure phase which has been found in nature. Now, this is the story of most of these high-pressure phases. Almost all of them were formed in the laboratory first. Then people went out in nature and looked for them, and found them in meteorites mostly, and impact ejecta from meteorites. Stishovite was the first example of this, actually. So most of the mineral names that I've used are authentic mineral names. These have been found in nature. Exceptions include perovskite, which hasn't been found in nature yet. If it hasn't been found in nature yet, what we do is we assign it the name of a real mineral that has the same structure but a different composition. So if you talk to a mineralogist, perovskite means calcium titanate, all right? So which is a very rare mineral that occurs in some igneous settings. Yes?
Last I was a little confused by the description of how you get the pressure. Because you think you imply you need each other for both models.
Ah, yes.
In principle, you don't actually need to know that, get density directly from pre-oscillation frequencies, and then you can get gravity and then you get pressure. So it's, you know, it's, you don't have to make the assumption that that was really. I think it's what you're implying.
Yes. Thanks for pointing that out. And I didn't mean to imply that the seismic models of density are based on the Adams-Williamson equation, because that gives you the wrong answer. I was looking at it more from the mineral physics point of view. If you wanted to come up with the pressure inside the Earth without reference to seismology, how would you do it? And in that case, you would combine these two equations, dpdr equals rho g, and dpd rho equals k on rho. And the bulk modulus and the density are something we know is a function of pressure and temperature. So in principle, you could figure out what the pressure distribution in the Earth is without reference to seismology. So I was thinking of it from that perspective, from the purely mineral physics perspective. Nobody's done that as far as I know. But it's just a statement that you could do it in principle. And the point I wanted to make about that, and thanks for reminding me, is what this bulk modulus is here. So bulk modulus is the rate at which the density changes with pressure. So a seismic wave comes through a particular piece of the Earth, and it applies a little bit of pressure to the material, and the material responds by increasing its density. And so the ratio of the pressure change to the density change gives you this bulk modulus over density. Now, that bulk modulus that a seismic wave measures is not the bulk modulus that you would use to get at the pressure distribution in the Earth, because there are some places in the Earth where the density changes much more rapidly than that. Okay, so here, for example, here the pressures, the density is changing much, is changing very, very rapidly with pressure. It's changing almost discontinuously. All right, so the pressure change might be small, but the density change is huge. And so the bulk modulus in this vicinity of this phase transformation must be very, very small. All right, now this gets into what the definition of the bulk modulus is. Whenever we talk about thermodynamic properties, we have to be careful about taking these derivatives, because often we take the derivatives holding one or another other thermodynamic property fixed. So for example, the most common definitions of the bulk modulus are the bulk modulus at constant temperature, which is rho dp d rho at constant temperature, or the adiabatic bulk modulus. This is rho dp d rho at constant entropy. And something that is often not noted explicitly in these formula is that often when we're talking about these things, we're also holding something else fixed, and that is the composition of all the phases involved. Okay? So if we also hold the amounts and the compositions of all the phases of our rock constant, this is the thing that seismology measures, that seismology is sensitive to. But what that definition of the bulk modulus doesn't include is these rapid changes in the bulk modulus due to phase transformations. This is what's known as the frozen bulk modulus. And in many applications, what we're interested in, including if you wanted to get at the pressure distribution from the mineral physics point of view, you would need the unfrozen bulk modulus, which would be still at constant entropy, but now specify a thermodynamic equilibrium among all the coexisting phases. So as the pressure changes, you allow the relative proportions of phases to change and allow those changes to contribute to the density change. And this is the unfrozen or equilibrium bulk modulus. They can differ by orders of magnitude, especially if you're in this region where right in a phase transformation where the density can change a huge amount with a very, very small increment of pressure, they can differ by orders of magnitude.
Is it because the frozen one is just undefined in those places?
No, it's perfectly well defined. If you deform the material on time scales too rapidly, that are too rapid for phase transformation to take place, which is often the case with the passage of a seismic wave, then you'll get this, and it's a perfectly well-defined thing.
Well, when seismic waves place up near the earth is a conservation formation?
The conventional wisdom is no. The conventional wisdom is that they do not. Now, there are details of that argument, and some people like Rick O'Connell and others have looked at it very carefully and looked at just the quantitative extent to which the statement I just made is true. But the conventional wisdom is that they do not induce phase transformations, that the time scale of the deformation is just too fast. And the kinetics of the phase transformation too slow. This distinction between frozen and unfrozen we'll get back to, because it is important not only for the bulk modulus, but also for things like the thermal expansivity and other things. And I hope to explore some of these things in one of the tutorials. Yes? Yes. One of the things I washed over, and this is something that we need to get back to in a subsequent lecture, is how I got from here, properties of all these minerals, to here, properties of the rock. All right? And for the bulk modulus, it's very well defined. But what Don might be getting at is what about the shear wave velocities? And the shear wave velocities, Vs, Vp of a rock, okay, what do these depend on? They depend on the Vs and Vp of the minerals, but they also depend on something else. They depend on the texture, that is, the relative sizes of the different mineral grains, whether the grains are distributed heterogeneously or homogeneously throughout the rock. It also depends on those things. So the seismic wave velocities of a rock are inherently uncertain unless you know all the details of all the geometry of every crystal size and shape and relative position, all right? This uncertainty due to texture is something that you can quantify. You can put rigorous bounds on what the seismic wave velocities of a rock might be, sort of looking at all possible textures. And you can place these rigorous bounds called the Voigt and Royce bounds. And throughout most of the mantle, these tend to differ from each other by a small amount, perhaps a percent or so. So this, which might be significant in some cases, but it's not something that we generally worry about to first order, because this is something like what our experimental uncertainties are, or perhaps greater. Yes. That's right. It doesn't. Well, let me think about that. No. You're right. It matters for bulk modulus too. It does. Yes. Although quantitatively it matters less so, it turns out, unless you're talking about a material that compresses very anisotropically. So for clay, for example, the Voigt and Royce bounds on the bulk modulus can differ by a lot, like 20% or something. But for mantle minerals, they differ by typically a percent or so, or less. Yeah?
Following on the theme from day one, we look at it at a certain frequency, and maybe that's one thing we want to look at, the high frequency approximations, we talk about what the structure is, the function of that. So if I measure, what is the function of that for both models? When I measure the P row, that even in a place where we're not warming in the world of animal, that could be different from the P row that you really want at essentially low frequency where everything is relaxing.
Right.
It's really exciting at the high frequencies and seeing a different property of what it's actually seeing that in its response to perturbation. It would be different, not by much.
Another way to look at this difference between frozen and unfrozen bulk moduli that I've been talking about is in terms of the inhomogeneity parameter that difference is essentially the inhomogeneity parameter in different units, but that's basically all it is. Yeah.
Is there any evidence, or could you tell, if there were compositional differences across the 616?
That's something that a lot of people have looked at, and it turns out that if there are compositional differences, they're pretty small, and they're at the limit of current uncertainties in the experimental and theoretical determinations of the material properties. So if there is a compositional difference, we don't have the resolution to detect it. But it's something that people used to worry about a lot. They don't worry about as much anymore, partly because of this resolution issue. It's a very important question. A compositional difference across 660 is certainly not something we can rule out on the basis of mineral physics.
Can you constrain it in some units?
It could be, I guess it could be a percent or two in density. The inherent compositional contribution to the density difference could be that large, which might be dynamically significant, actually. I mean, that's at the level that could be dynamically significant. Yeah, sure, sure.
Even if it wasn't dynamically,
yeah,
that's significant. I remember Dave Shirley, a long time ago, wrote something out there, published it, about the potential effects of small differences in silica would be, I can't remember.
Right. Yeah, if you change the, what people have tended to focus on are the relative proportions of olivine and pyroxene, or translated into lower mantle mineralogy, the relative proportions between perovskite and magnesioworstite. And one of the things that people have focused on is whether the lower mantle is pyrolytic, which I've assumed in everything I've done here, or whether it's closer to pure perovskite. And if it were pure perovskite, that would be very interesting for a number of reasons. I published a paper that claimed that that was provided the best match to lower mantle properties of pure perovskite lower mantle back in 91 or so. One key need is to be able to compare to all the observations that we have of the lower mantle. One of the big gaps in mineral physics knowledge has been that we know something about the density and the bulk modulus, but much less about the shear modulus. And we're starting to fill in that gap now, and I think you'll see that as people learn more and more about what the shear modulus of lower mantle mineralogies are, these comparisons will come back and people will start to re-examine what the composition of the lower mantle is. And also in the context of possible changes in bulk composition of the lower mantle as you go deeper. Right.
It's not very large, even taking into account the spread effect, which was actually lower, it's just more 1.5 to 2%. So then the uncertainty, of course, as has less than 21st. But then there's another issue that I think is interesting, you know, again, thinking about seismology and the new dynamics and different timescales. Maybe the static picture of Europe could support that density difference in time.
And if it's there, how? And if it's there, how is it produced? That would be another interesting question that would go back to the early evolution. There was a question over here.
Yeah, it's probably when you answer it easily, but on the pyrolite chart you had, it said 100 million years on it.
Yes.
Why is it 100 million years?
What I wanted to do was to capture not only the change in temperature adiabatically with depth, but also the thermal boundary layer at the surface. And I just took one example of what that thermal boundary layer might look like, what a 100-million-year-old oceanic lithosphere would look like thermally, just to see what the effects of that would be. So that's what the 100-million-year-old referred to, 100 million years of half-space cooling.
Okay.
I didn't show that, no. And I, in words, I sort of listed some of the similarities and differences. If we specifically focus on the Prem then, or any 1D seismic model, really, the low velocity zone is there. Okay, the 410, 660, 520 are there. These discontinuities look very different from at least some 1D seismological models. Some models show a rapid decrease in velocity at about 65 kilometers, called the Gutenberg or G discontinuity. And there's no hint of that in at least this best guess of what pyrolite does. Now, that's one of the reasons why I wrote these things down here, is that one way to get that rapid decrease in velocity at 65 kilometers might be a sudden increase in attenuation. This is something that people have proposed, or a sudden change in the pattern of anisotropy. All mantle minerals are anisotropic, so if you align them in a mantle flow field, seismology will see anisotropy, will be sensitive to that anisotropy. And if you get a sudden change in the anisotropy, like you might get at the lithosphere convecting mantle boundary, then you can get a sudden change in seismic wave velocity.
One of the big proponents of Gary's short, right?
Yes.
They always say something called a melt separation zone. How would that fit into what you just described?
Right. The basic idea there is that the extraction of basaltic melt begins at about 65 kilometers. So below 65 kilometers, you've got totally normal mantle, all right? And above 65, shallower than 65 kilometers, weird things are going to happen. And as you extract the basaltic melt from this whole column, from 65 kilometers up to the surface, you're extracting various elements, you're replacing normal mantle with Hartzbergite, you're also extracting all the water. And it's that water which might play the key role in all this, because the attenuation will be very sensitive to water. So 65 kilometers might represent a boundary between dry stuff and wet stuff, and therefore a sharp boundary between low attenuation and high attenuation. That's the Garrity and Jordan story in a nutshell. Caroline and I have looked at this a little bit quantitatively, and our sense is that the temperature at 65 kilometers is so low and the attenuation is so low that this wet to dry transition is not going to make a lot of difference. And so that would tend to rule out that as an explanation of the G discontinuity. But I don't have a good explanation otherwise, except for anisotropy. Anisotropy is sort of a wild card that could produce it.